Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is January 9th, 2014. Yes, it's a new year. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. If you haven't read and listened to the wrap-up, I really encourage you to do it. It's a very important framework to help us understand what's happening as we go forward in 2014. The web presentation was done. I wanted to use a lot of graphs and charts, so please take a look at it. The link is up on the blog on the wrap-up. Of course, our poster for this year, you know we do one poster every year to capture the spirit of that year, is Breakaway, and a beautiful painting from a wonderful Spanish artist in the Pyrenees. Anyway, take a look at the Breakaway poster. Definitely read that web presentation. I think it will really help you understand a lot of what we're saying going forward. Our theme tonight is Failure is an Option, from the blog post commentary I wrote this week entitled Failure is an Option. Quoting Elon Musk, failure is an option here. If things are not failing, you are not innovating enough. It was inspired by a CBS story that a subscriber sent called The Clean Tech Crash. Leslie Stahl followed around a very wonderful entrepreneur who's investing in a lot of clean tech companies and proceeded to rip them apart for things not necessarily working. And he pointed out that, of course, to get something to work, you have to try stuff, and stuff is going to fail. And it was very interesting because we're living in a world where there are two models. We have, and this is, if you read the wrap-up, you'll hear more about this, but we have one economy, which I called Global 2.0, and it's full of large organizations, both government and private, that have more liabilities than they have assets. And of course, when you're in that situation, and they're also heavily dependent on the bond market, which is now struggling with the accumulated weight of decades of credit bubbles and currency wars and derivative issues. So resources are precious, and everyone's feeling very risk averse. Now, as we know, one of the reasons you're short on assets is because they've been shifted out by the financial coup d'etat to Global 3.0. We made a big chart in the wrap-up that you can take a look at and sort of see all the different money leaving 2.0 and going to 3.0. 3.0 is now filled with private entrepreneurs and investors, and that money is beginning to flow because with the Fed finishing quantitative easing, between the bailouts and quantitative easing, that literally you've seen the criminal liabilities be shredded and the statute of limitation pass. So you're watching that money begin to really flow, and as that is happening, 3.0 is growing. Now, one of the critical issues in the growth of 3.0 is the speed at which people all over the world are getting online through a smartphone or a tablet. And that kind of connectivity is fundamentally changing how a lot of consumer markets work with respect to anything that can be delivered through technology or the financial payment mechanism can be delivered. I use the, both in the wrap-up and in the commentary, I describe the fact that literally since fall of 2011, we've seen the number of people online with a smart device go from about 850 million to over 1.6 billion. And it's growing tremendously. Now, as Business Insider explains, and you can see the chart up on the wrap-up, about 70% of the money is currently online. Now, of course, as that grows, money is going to become a much more available thing to billions of more people. Anyway, it's re-engineering both sides of the balance sheet, both the asset side and the liability side. So it's both money and the fundamental industries. If you're an app developer, then instead of marketing to 300 million Americans, you can be marketing to 1.6 people around the globe. Anyway, in Global 2.0, failure is not an option. In Global 3.0, when you have that many people connected, failure is an option. Speed is important, so it's important to do trial and error. And you and I are literally this year going back and forth between cultures and economies which are extremely risk-averse, very critical, very angry, and other ones that are very creative and very innovative. And I said in my commentary today, This is a year where I'm going to have two hats. One hat is Global 2.0. The other is Global 3.0. When I have the first hat on, it's risk off. When I have the second hat on, it's risk on. So get ready for a two hat kind of year. Money and markets. The big story, absolutely, is that Janet Yellen has been confirmed as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve. It's very interesting, a very interesting thing because we lucked out. We got somebody who's enormously qualified. Whether you like the Fed or not, better that you have a competent person running it. This is someone who's been an economist at the Fed. She was governor of the Fed as well, president of San Francisco Fed, then vice chairman. So she's been Bernanke's vice chairman. You can expect a smooth transition. I find it very interesting that she was president of the San Francisco Fed with digital currencies on the rise. The San Francisco Fed is going to be a very, very important link in the network. Another thing is she's got an extraordinary history, apparently, of forecasting the economy. So it's somebody who's really made an effort to understand the economy. And she's a mother. She's clearly evidenced focus on human capital, the importance of unemployment, and many things that can't be measured. I mean, anybody who's a mother knows the way you build a great economy is one child at a time, and it's not a simple or easy task. And if you destroy a great deal of human capital with unemployment, you know, it's going to create very long-term problems. Now, her negative is that she never completely understood the fraud and certainly has tolerated a great deal of it. So the reality, though, is you're never going to get it. Anybody who wouldn't tolerate the fraud wouldn't be there. So I have to say, I think we're extraordinarily lucky to have her as Fed chairman at this time. Her challenge is she's going to be one hand clapping. If she's running monetary policy and she can't get Congress to begin to address the problems at hand with fiscal policy, without the two hands clapping, it's going to be hard to get something done. But I don't underestimate the power of her ability to push and collaborate and build consensus. She's an extraordinarily intelligent, hardworking, and patient person. The vice chairman, Stanley Fischer, I have big question marks about. I keep thinking about the time when I was assistant secretary. The secretary would call me in and say, I want you to go do X. And then he'd call my deputy in and said, I just told Fitz to do X, make sure she fails. And that's because for legal reasons, he had to look like he was doing one thing, but for political reasons, he had to do another. And so you would have this multiple personality disorder. And if you look at Stanley Fischer and who he is, my hope is he's as supportive a vice chairman of Yellen as she was to Bernanke, but you're always concerned that because a variety of interests couldn't get Summers in there, that they're putting another guy in to carry their water. And let's just hope they're a working team. The equity markets opened the year strong. Trim Tabs reported in 2013 we had a record flow of money into equities, $352 billion. That eclipses the old record from 2000. At the same time, bonds had a net outflow of $86 billion. So the question is, of course, is this the great start of the rotation from bonds to equities? I think the jury's still out. We were having this month's equity overview at the end of the month. We'll be on the bond question, what's going to happen in the bond market. And I think all eyes are on the bond market and on interest rates, part because the Fed is planning on starting to taper in January. But if you look at the charts that we had in the wrap-up of the history of interest rates, what you'll see is interest rates have been falling steadily from 1980 until last year, and of course they started to turn up, and it's expected to happen to continue this year. So that's a big overhang, and as I talked about in the precious metals market report, you could see a wide variability of scenarios because the bond market has been supplying enormous amounts of money and capital to many of the things driving up the equity markets or keeping many households going. And so if interest rates rise and the bond market has to turn and can't support deficit spending, we're going to have some very big changes in policy. I don't expect to see Congress do a lot on the fiscal policy front. You have elections in 2014, so Congress is going to do everything they can to kick the can. If you want a picture of how to do things right, the story up on the blog today, there was no financial coup d'etat in Norway. They took all the money they made from the oil revenues, put it in a sovereign wealth fund, saved it very, very prudently today. It crossed $1 million per person in Norway. So sovereign, instead of Norway having a deficit per person in terms of retirement liabilities, Norway has a surplus of $1 million per person invested in global equities sitting in their sovereign wealth fund. Wow. Just a reminder of what you can do. One of the subscribers sent me a article on the IMF statement that we should levy a significant global tax on everyone in the West, in the developed world, to essentially deal with and wipe out the debt problem. I would point out, as shocking and sort of scary an article that is, if you look at the monetary policies being implemented through debasement, it's essentially doing that. I mean, the debasement has been far greater than the percentages of taxes being bandied about in that article or by any of the IMF. And if you look at what debasement is doing, I assure you we're doing it through monetary policy instead of fiscal policy. Tax is a fiscal policy, but it has the same effect. And the reality is we need a plan to deal with and get the debt behind us. One thing I would note, you can probably hear it in my voice, a lot of the United States has been dealing with unprecedented cold. I was up in Connecticut last weekend and just ran up for a business meeting and came back. It was very cold. It's unbelievable here in Tennessee. Reports from Michigan, Minnesota, people really struggling with record cold. And as I say in the wrap-up, weird weather is another one of the wild cards, and we're certainly feeling it in the United States this week. Technology is going to be always at the top of the headlines this year, so get ready. One of the stories up on the blog is the Canadian cloud and hosting provider Pier One has published a study of 300 businesses in the UK and Canada. Now, remember, UK and Canada are our closest allies. The survey shows 25% intend to move their company data out of the United States over NSA fears. The 80% consider privacy laws as the primary factor when deciding where they're stored data. Now, if you watch the NSA scandals and you're a company with data and operations in the U.S. cloud, you know, it takes a fair amount of time to cycle out, to make your plans, to find other ways to migrate programs, data. These are complicated issues for operating companies. And yet, if you look at the long-term reverberations, it's going to be significant. We just see a headline today that India has turned down a collaboration with Google. And I think really related to privacy concerns again. Can Google be trusted? I would tell them absolutely not. I think they made a very wise decision. But we are now beginning to watch a world where United States brands are going to be questioned. Again, expect changes, Congress making more changes in the laws so that the cloud companies can get back in the competition. Apple announced that their App Store, are you ready for this? Talk about 1.6 million people online. They announced their App Store generated $1 billion of sales in December. The final month of 2013, their annual sales were $10 billion. And Apple also noted that to date, developers have made over $15 billion on apps sold on the Apple Store. That's quite extraordinary, and it goes to show you that now companies are looking to the extent they can distribute or market online, they're looking at a market of 1.6 billion in global consumers. America is no longer the mother of all marketplaces. European Union is no longer the mother of all marketplaces. It's a global market, and you'll see in many commentaries and wrap-ups for the year that it's a lot of discussion of the Internet of Things and getting everything hooked up and linked. One example of that is that Google and Apple both announced deals with car companies to start to be part of the networking of cars. The chairman of Broadband referred to the car as the new living room. We see AT&T working hard to kill net neutrality. They're now encouraging companies to fund free access of their apps or browsers through their AT&T platform. Huh, what a criminal. Anyway, AT&T, we have a rule at Solari. You may not use AT&T without a waiver from me. Another story up on the blog, inside story of Snapchat, the world's hottest app, or a $3 billion disappearing act. Snapchat is a new form of, it's an app. You can send a message to someone that will then disappear. It's a way of protecting your privacy. Very clever. It's much more popular with the teenagers, apparently. Surveys show it's much more successful than Facebook with a younger audience. Facebook offered $3 billion to buy it. They turned it down. And the next thing you know, they got hit with all sorts of technical glitches. I suspect it was economic warfare at its best. So let's see if Snapchat makes it out. There are other new services coming out that are going to do the same thing. I think we're going to see a wave of encryption and privacy and all sorts of very clever workarounds. And that's a very good thing. Our hero today is a fabulous woman. Her name is Anousheh Ansari. She moved from Iran after the revolution to America. She's an engineer and businesswoman, and always as a child had a passion for space, and later became one of the first private citizens to travel to space. I first learned about her because a wonderful subscriber from Colorado sent me a book that she had written about her experiences. And then last weekend, I read Realizing Tomorrow, A History of Private Space Flight. I posted a review of it up on the blog. And I used a quote from her. She got permission from the International Space Station to blog. So she was the first space blogger, if you will. And a remarkable woman, and really brings a woman's touch to the topic of space. And I look forward to reading her book and thank that subscriber for putting me onto her. I think a remarkable woman and someone who's very inspiring. If you think about what I wrote in the wrap-up about this concept of breakaway, I think she's just the kind of person who can help us break away. Ask Catherine. We had some great questions this week. Someone sent in a link about a presentation on C-SPAN about the police state and all the things going on that would inspire a police state, and said, can you believe this is on C-SPAN? Absolutely, and I'll tell you why. If you count up the growing market share of the media on the internet that's telling the truth, it continues to suck hits and activity out of major media. And as that's happening, major media is struggling to find ways to do what I call limited modified hangouts that address the same issues but bring everybody back into the system. It's part of their way of covering market share and protecting market share, but also constantly reaffirming the legitimacy of the system. So am I surprised to see it on C-SPAN? No. But it really will tell you something about how many inroads people like Alex Jones at InfoWars are making. Hi, Catherine. I learned about your work through other alternative media gurus like Max Kaiser, Alex Jones, and Greg Hunter. I've always been a sincere admirer of your work. I also have always been a fan of the calming nature of your perspective, and just recently decided to dive in and become a Solari member. Wow, what a value. After studying carefully over these past 5 years, the financial crisis of 2008-2007, I feel like I have duly diversified my family's assets into all of the regular libertarian means of doing so: gold, silver, foods, guns, ammo, and currency. Now I'm starting to relook at getting back into equity, and I'm studying your material specifically to try and find a pathway back into the equity world as you and the Solari community are creating it. As a non-accredited retail investor, what would you recommend I do to get restarted in equities? Thanks for all you do, and I hope to get to meet you someday. Oh, thank you so much. What a wonderful note. And I will look for a way to do a Solari lunch in your town, because I know where you are. Anyway, we did a Solari report with Paul Ferguson on doing a Solari circle as an investment club, and you might want to think about identifying other people to do that with, because of the nature of the laws applying and the regulations applying to investment advisory. I don't give investment advice, so I'm not going to identify securities or make specific recommendations on the Solari report. I can't do that. But one of the things I would say is I really think if you read the wrap-up and think a little bit about 2.0 and 3.0 and start to understand where the growth is in 3.0, especially if you listen to the Solari reports as we talk about it, what it means for different industries, I think you'll get a notion of where the opportunities are going to be for 3.0. So I think that that would help. But consider doing a Solari circle with people whose skills and knowledge in the 3.0 areas are strong. Dear Catherine and Solari, in case you haven't seen this video featuring Judge, how do you pronounce his name? Napolitano, I'm forwarding it to you. During this clip, he talks candidly about how bogus the entire political process is and how the people we elect from either the Democrat or the Republican Party are just basically following the same agenda with us without any differences. John Fox was canceled soon after he made this presentation. That doesn't surprise me. Hello, Catherine. How does one find the databases that your community wizard accessed? I have no idea how to find this information on my own to find out how our money is being spent. Search terms or things to look for. You want to look for the CAFRs, the Consolidated Annual Financial Reports. You can find them for your state, your county, and possibly municipality. If you find those and then start to dig into, you can, usually the websites of most counties or municipalities and states will have their budgets and financial statements. And if you dig into those as well as the CAFRs, and you'll find a great deal. And then you can identify other pools of capital, including pension funds in both state and local pension funds in your area. You can also identify big not-for-profits with big endowments. And there's a lot of disclosure available about them as well. And finally, of course, for any big companies in your area, the SEC has a wealth of documentation. As if the company is publicly traded or has securities outstanding, it's required to file with the SEC. So I would start with the CAFRs and then go to the state and local municipal budgets and then go to the other pools of capital, starting with the pension funds, but also look at corporations. I participate in a 401k enough to get the 5% match. There are various levels of investment fund options based on the matrix of current ages, years to retirement. I'm 54 and have been contributing for 12 years. The only debt is the mortgage, and that should be paid off by the time I'm 60. Right now, I'm in an aggressive group, but with the threat of bail-ins and retirement confiscation, I wonder if it wouldn't be more prudent to stop contributing and pay off the house. Here's what I would say. I think there is a reasonable chance, as we've talked on the equity overviews and I talk about in the wrap-up, that we could have what's called a crash-up in the stock market. If we do have a rotation out of the bond market and into equities, you could look, despite all the fiscal problems, you could have a relatively strong stock market. So as long as the stock market is staying high, my inclination would be to continue with it as long as you are going to have your house paid off by 60. If the equity markets start to turn down more than 10 or 15%, you may consider, in fact, paying off the house. I'm somebody who does not like to have a lot of debt, and I see the benefits of doing that. However, if we do have a crash up in the equity markets, you'll be better off staying invested. Confiscation, I think, you know, we've so far, The policy talk is about forcing small businesses to have 401ks, so they're looking to force more money into that system as opposed to confiscate. Not to say that a tax couldn't come along or debasement couldn't continue to drain. And then finally, you and Dr. Farrell are a trip. Glad you enjoyed it. Okay, here's a long one. I watched your talk at the Breakthrough Energy Conference last year in Holland. I think you're a fantastic speaker and have such an interesting viewpoint. You give me hope that we can intelligently get out of our mess. While listening to you speak, I was wondering if philosophically, do you agree with Google that all tasks that are mundane or dangerous should be automated, or do you see pitfalls in that philosophy? I see enormous pitfalls in that philosophy. We are coming into a period of unprecedented automation, just unprecedented automation. And I think the big struggle that Yellen's going to have at the Fed is that automation is going to devastate employment. I don't think we've seen anything yet. And of course, the increased connectivity globally is also going to mean much more can be outsourced. I see a lot of insourcing happening in manufacturing, but it's going to create jobs for engineers, not for many of the average people. So I see enormous pitfalls because, I think there are many tasks that the chairman or CEO of Google might think are mundane, but I know plenty of people in this economy who would enjoy doing it and want to do that job. Then the author writer continues, and related to the eliminating the mundane, I dream about a small farming robot that is cheap to manufacture and service, perhaps solar-powered and constantly upgraded with open-source software. Perhaps many of the parts for these robots could even be manufactured at home on 3D printers. These robots would farm the land in people's yard and supplement their family food supply. This is a great idea. My first thought is that no large company interested in control would ever finance the building of such a robot, because it would throw the current food status quo off kilter. So the robot would necessarily have to be a citizen-driven project away from corporate control. My second thought is such a robot would put a lot of low-skill, low-wage workers out of business. Do you think putting so many poor folks out of work would increase suffering overall or further destabilize society? I think there's a way that such automation can be integrated in a way that increases the opportunities available to such poor folks. I don't think automation necessarily has to, especially if we can do open source things that we can make ourselves, it can energize poor folks and not destabilize them. Do I think that the current automation is being introduced in a way that will help poor folks? No. But again, that's not automation in and of itself. That's how capital and resources are being allocated and controlled. And as you know, I think a lot of the goals of the leadership is control, control, control. Another person writes, have you seen Joseph Farrell's blog for today? Is this possibly globally by the IMF and company? They're referring to the idea of a global tax. Remember, we're starting 2014, and whether it happens this year or 2016, or 2017, or 2018, we're headed into a day of reckoning about the debt. I think Obamacare, if we were all in a state of denial about what that meant, Obamacare has really put it front and center. So the denial is slowly going to come off in 2014, and we're going to have to face the imbalance between assets and liabilities in the 2.0 model, and that's why I think it's very important to be prepared mentally and emotionally and financially, if you can, to break away. So again, check out the wrap-up. Let's go to the movies. I wanted to review Oliver Stone's epic documentary, The Untold History of the United States. What I have to say is, you almost wonder if this is the real Oliver Stone we've always known and loved, who made JFK, or this is his evil twin. This is a 10-episode documentary, so 10 one-hour shows. There's great footage if you want to see lots of great footage from the history of America. a real focus on World War II and the bomb up through the last four administrations. There's a lot of good stuff. The problem is the story he tells is not the real story. It's very misleading at times. There are portions that are very real and bring some interesting tidbits up, but you really don't get the real story. And the best part of it is that he shows the extent of the violence of what is going on in the United States. And I think we in North America are often very protected from that. It's a little bit hard to watch, but you get an extent of the extraordinary violence of the central banking warfare model and of the extent of the genocide that's been going on for the last 120 years. It's quite remarkable. But there it is, Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States. It's not the full untold history. It's kind of a modified hangout. Our interview is posted. I wanted to talk about precious metals on my own just because it's the beginning of a new year, and I have a very clear concept of how we should manage our both core position and investment position in gold and silver going forward. And what I found was subscribers were often confused when Franklin and I were disagreeing. So I decided I would just do it myself. And then Franklin will be joining us in February to talk about his jailhouse ministry in local economies. And then he'll be back in April. We're going to make the precious metals report quarterly for 2014. So we look forward to having him back. And that interview is posted up on the blog. Well, that's it. Next week, we have a wonderful interview with a very special person, Ann Christensen from New Mexico, on Estate Planning 101. This is a topic that, it's the perfect thing to talk about in January. It's time to get everything organized. And I found it is a terrible mistake to go off to the attorney before you've thought things out clearly. Ann is a very seasoned and experienced trust officer and does a wonderful job of helping us think about these things clearly, and has agreed to join us to talk about Estate Planning 101. Then we have John Rappaport the following week, and then the equity report again, the bond markets, the head of the dog wagging the tail. Precious metals and equities are both on the tail, so we're going to be talking about the bond market, interest rates, and what that might mean for how things could go in 2014. So until next week with Ann Christensen on estate planning, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is January 9th, 2014. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted to be speaking with you this evening. Tonight is the first precious metals market report of the new year, 2014. It's going to be a very fruitful year. I'm looking forward to this one. I am doing the precious metals market report tonight alone. And that's because I wanted to begin the year by presenting a framework on how I'm approaching precious metals in 2014. I want to make sure you have a framework for your precious metals holdings in 2014. Franklin will be back and join us on the next one. We'll be doing the precious metals market reports quarterly in 2014. He's also going to be joining us in February to do a discussion of his jailhouse ministry and local economy, something I very much want you to hear about. I enjoy sparring with Franklin on the points where we disagree, but one of the things I've discovered in recent Solaria reports is that it can be very confusing for the subscribers. And because it was important to me that you start off the year with a clear framework on how to approach precious metals, I thought, okay, well, maybe we'll just do a fireside chat with me alone. I strongly recommend for any consideration of precious metals or any assets, any part of the financial markets, that you read the special web presentation we did for the year-end wrap-up. We put it up last week. You can link to it from your from both the resource center, your subscriber resource center, as well as the blog post on the annual wrap-up. It's critical background for this report and for a lot of the things we're going to be doing this year. I think it's going to put a lot of things in perspective. So I strongly recommend you read that. The web presentation has a lot of graphs and charts. So I would certainly make sure you take a look at that, even if you listen to the audio. Let's start on precious metals with what happened last year, because last year was quite, one person called it carnage. You know, precious metals, gold certainly had outperformed the Dow for 12 years straight. And then not only did it not perform well, if you'd had a dollar in gold at the beginning of the year and bought the S&P 500, when the year was over, you would have had $1.30 as opposed to 58 cents less than if you bought the S&P. So it was a very wide spread in terms of performance. And, of course, the mining stocks down more than 50%. So needless to say, we started the year at 1,700 and went down as low as almost to 1,100 and then ended the year a little bit over the 1,200 line. Let's just sort of look at the year chronologically. In January of 2013, Germany asked for their gold back, so we had repatriation. Venezuela had asked for their gold back, and we saw a dip in the price when that happened. So Germany asked for their gold back in January, and so in the first quarter, gold went from 1,700 to 1,600. In April, during the bail-in equivalent on Cyprus, the reports went out that Cyprus was being asked to sell its gold reserves, and that was sort of dampening on the gold price. But then we have what I would call the Goldman bear raid, which was the same week as the Boston Marathon bombing and the attempt to pass CISPA. David Colum, who is a professor, organic chemistry professor at Cornell, writes a great review for the year, and I posted it up on the blog. Let me just read you what he wrote about that week. China imported record amounts of gold in March. Soon thereafter, Obama met with bankers, and a few days later, Goldman tells the world to short gold. When was the last time a major brokerage declared an all-out short against any asset class? Hint, never. After an odd two-day calm, gold got absolutely crushed. We're not talking skittish investors starting to move in concert, but a real stampede. Thousands of future contracts were sold in 1 second, billions of dollars worth of future contracts in 15 minutes, tens of billions in 1 day. A single trade of 2 million ounces crushed the CME computers. An unprecedented collapse of the trading platform in the physical gold marketplace and the shutdown of Kitco's pricing mechanism, brilliantly timed for sell-off Friday, forced panicky gold bugs looking to hedge for the weekend into the options market, driving the prices even lower. The CME decided that was an excellent opportunity to raise margin requirements by 18.5%, which was guaranteed to force more selling. The Friday glitch-a-thon gave the brokerages ample time to line up their margin calls to ensure selling continued unabated the following Monday. It was pandemonium in the gold markets. That, folks, was a textbook bear raid brought to you by Goldman Sachs and heaven knows what other powerful forces. It left serious, quote, technical damage, quote, which is euphemism for merciless beatings with baseball bats. And it certainly was. Literally within 24 hours, gold broke from 1530 down to 1395. Shortly thereafter, the next week, we had brokers throwing clients out of the brokerage firm if they continued to hold gold. I had one brokerage firm call me and say they wanted all clients who held more than 10 or 20% of gold to either leave the firm or sell down to that level. The reason being they had an audit coming in from the regulators, and because of Dodd-Frank, they didn't want more than 10 to 20%. It was considered to be not suitable. Interestingly enough, 2 months later, I got the gold salesman from the same firm calling me and asking me if he could introduce the services of that firm to buy gold. We saw restrictions added around the world by various governments, regulatory restrictions and exchanges. The big one, of course, being in India, where significant tariffs and taxes were added, essentially creating import restrictions that really shut down the Indian market. We had France ban the sale of gold and silver by mail. Vietnamese authorities forced banks to charge for gold storage. And we had numerous countries around the world causing different sort of actions. At the same time, physical tonnage left just started shooting out of the GLD inventory, GLD being the big gold ETF, inventory dropping at COMEX, and inventory dropping at Brinks, inventory dropping at JP Morgan, which was rumored to have eventually been covering their shorts. Hopefully, the gold bugs feel coming into the new year 2014 where their shorts covered and long. At one point, the Hong Kong Metals Exchange was liquidated and closed. ABN AMRO and Rabobank defaulted, telling their customers that their allocated gold had been rehypothecated and payment would be in cash, if you can imagine that. We even had Texas start to repatriate its gold, with Governor Perry declaring, "We don't just want the certificates, we want our gold, and if you're the state of Texas, you should be able to get your gold." While this was all happening, we also saw numerous countries starting to build out gold exchanges, start gold exchanges. And as the gold started to shift, still big purchases in China and big purchases by the central bank, what we did see was we saw gold beginning to spread around to many more buyers and certainly globally. And if anything, if you're looking very long-term, building a much broader base on the gold and silver inventory and a much wider base globally is probably much, much better for the long-term bull market in gold. Now, it's interesting. Let's start looking at this year. So we closed the year with gold bumping along the 1,200 line. We opened strongly. Now, what's interesting is Goldman, who is, you know, at this point is the top dog in running the bear positions in the market. Goldman announced that the gold price would be at 1050 by the end of the year. A little bit of history. Lloyd Blankfein, who's the chairman of Goldman, and his number two, Gary Cohen, came out of the gold desk at Aaron's. And when Goldman bought Aaron's, that merged into the fixed income division, which is where Blankfein and Cohen sort of came up. And if you read my old posts about Goldman, I believe that they were instrumental in managing a lot of the strong dollar policy, which was bubbling the mortgage market and doing a variety of things in the treasury market, and then also managing the gold price. And Blankfein and Cohen are uniquely positioned to know that. So we opened we're bouncing along across the 1200 line. It dipped below a couple times in December, but came back up. It started to open the year strong, and we even had Rambus from Rambus Chartology, who's the chartist who I follow a lot when it comes to precious metals. We even had Rambus announce he was closing his shorts because it looked like it was strong. And it's particularly noticeable if you look at how the gold price is bouncing along the 1200 support line. It looks like the way it bounced along the 1530 line before, in April 15th of 2012, it smashed down. And it seems to be bouncing along that 1200 line. Now, given what's going on in the market, you know, a serious bear raid like the kind we had in April could press it down. But there's also tremendous demand. If you look at how much the lower price has created very strong physical demand, particularly in Asia, if it does break through that 1200 line, I think you're going to hear some more giant sucking sounds into the middle class. Stuart Thompson of Graceland Updates makes the case, I think, very eloquently that the emerging middle class in Asia globally is very long-term bullish for gold. This is supply and demand. And in fact, I always believed that the powers that be wanted to manage rising gold. It was one of the reasons I felt confident about gold and silver. But they're not going to permit that if it in any way jeopardizes control of the reserve currency system. And so we come into a year where clearly both last year and now, gold is very much at the heart of a battle for control and management of the reserve currency. But we also see the countries in the G20 outside the G7 building out gold exchanges and looking to use gold as a major form of trade and settlement, and that's long-term bullish for gold. I think we have to go through a period where the shorts need to get covered. Within the financial institutions and the central bank, there are tremendous and very big shorts in the physical area. And so part of what we're watching with a much lower gold price is literally a confiscation by other means that helps all of those institutions cover those shorts. One of the big issues for all of us for 2014 in all markets, including precious metals, is that when you manage markets and you intercede in markets with the extreme ways that have happened as part of the financial coup d'etat and the bailouts, you get into a situation where you have a very wide possibility of scenarios. So, for example, if you look at one of the big issues for 2014, it's the extraordinary amount of leverage in the developed world, in Europe, in Japan, in the United States, and the continued deficit spending. On one hand, that could be bullish for gold, particularly in scenarios where you, for example, do something like a radical debasement. You'll hear the gold bugs talk about a scenario where gold suddenly pops to 5,000. Those are scenarios where radical debasement is done. So you get these scenarios that are extreme, both in terms of a high gold price or a very low price. If, for example, you resolve the budget issues in this country in a way that are very threatening to creditors and result in deflation, we could see a very low gold price. So the possibilities of what could happen are extreme, both on the, you know, arguing for a much higher gold price, arguing for a much lower gold price. If you look at probable scenarios, we've experienced decades of a long-term bond bull market in this country. It started to turn in 2013 with interest rates rising. There is a very wide expectation of interest rates continuing to rise this year. That rising interest rates could make life tougher for precious metals, especially if the New York Fed member banks continue to hold a lid on the price. So I think 2014 could easily be a problematic year for precious metals, but it's important to understand that absolutely anything could happen. As I encourage you to read the wrap-up, I also encourage you, Chuck Gibson and I, in the last week of this month, or for the equity overview, we're going to revisit the bond market and why the bond market and interest rates is the big dog that's going to wag all the different tails, and equities and precious metals are on the tail. So it's very important, if you're going to get swung around in the tail, to understand what's going on in the head, because the bond market's going to be the driver. Now, what does this all mean to you? I wrote an article in the fourth quarter called "What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals?" because I really believe we all needed a framework with which to approach ownership of precious metals. I divide any person or family's position in precious metals between sort of two positions. One is your core position and the other is your investment position. Let me just describe what these are. A core position of gold and silver is one that you hold as insurance for protection in the worst case scenario. And I use the quote I always love, which says, always keep enough gold on hand to bribe the border guards. So you've heard the wonderful stories of somebody during the Holocaust who was able to get out to Germany because they literally had gold coins buried in their backyard. Those are wonderful stories. But essentially, gold and silver is a tangible. You can put it in your pocket. You can walk away. It's not dependent on a government or a military to hold its value. It's liquid. If you have the right coins, it's recognized globally. So the core position is what you have for the worst case. It's what you have if any of the extreme scenarios occur where literally gold could go to $5,000 or $10,000. It's the position you have to protect yourself from that. One of the things that's very important to understand about a core position is that you will find that different people have very different needs for a core. So, for example, one of the ways I calculate a core is how much do you want per person and in how many places do you want it? If you're responsible for a family of five, you're going to want more core position than if you're responsible for yourself as an individual and have no family that you're responsible for. So how many people are you responsible for? How much purchasing power do you want in the worst case? Do you want a year? Do you want 2 years? Do you want 5 years? Again, how many places, how many jurisdictions do you want it in? There's also wide variation in terms of what a person believes the worst case or how likely the worst case is. If you think the worst case where you would need gold or silver is relatively high, you're going to want to have more than a person who doesn't feel as strongly. So, for example, I would much rather put, and I have put a lot more money into building my business than or in investing. I'm sort of a people investor and gifting or helping family and friends than I would put into gold or silver, because I think at the end of the day, if we hit a worst case scenario, what we're going to need is each other and sort of not only a resilient team, but resilient assets. So in many respects, you'll find some people would say, look, I'd much rather have land with a garden and an orchard and a, you know, an operating entity than gold and silver. Other people don't feel that way. They want money they can put in their pocket and hand across the border. So I think different people feel very differently about economic collapse or a scenario where gold and silver can rise tremendously in price, and having some will protect you from those price rises. So don't audit. Whenever anybody says, oh, you should have a core of X or you should have a core of X percent, I have problems relating to those kinds of advice, because I think everybody's different and you need a kind of insurance policy that is appropriate for you and your unique circumstance. So think a lot about what your core is and how much of your assets you want to dedicate to that core. And gold and silver is an excellent, excellent position to have for your core position. It is important that your core position is in physical, either that you can control or you believe you can access. So if you have it in another country, you need to make sure that it's in a depository where you think you can get it. So the first part of your position is a core position. The second is an investment position. And the reality is that an investment position has to be held as a part of a portfolio where whatever you're doing in your investment position, it has to be competitive with your other opportunities. And what I said in the article and it's sort of at the end of the last year is until the primary trend reasserts, and as I said before, I would define that as when the gold moves back through the 1530 line and holds that and continues to move up until the primary trend reasserts, there's no indication that gold or silver are a good investment or an attractive investment up against other investment categories, other than possibly as a short term. So, for example, this year, we could easily see gold and silver or gold move from where it is today, approximately 1200 line, up to about 1450 and back. It's probably, the likely scenario is we trade in that range. So I can easily see somebody saying, 1250 up to 1450 is an attractive investment. So, but those are short-term positions. For gold and silver to be a good long-term investment position, we're going to have to reprove the primary trend, and that means breaking through the 1530 line and holding that technical support line from my point of view. Now, there's a lot that could, as I said, that could swing investments one way or another. A big one being interest rates, because interest rates oftentimes, higher interest rates are not great for gold and silver because gold and silver don't offer a dividend or an interest. But a lot of what's going to happen this year will relate to the politics of the dollar and the bond market. And if we're in an environment where essentially the New York Fed member banks take a position that they're going to keep gold down, I would submit that they have the power to do it. I would also submit that ultimately the nature of the demand coming from Asia and the growth of an emerging market middle class is going to overwhelm the market. So fundamentals matter, but that doesn't mean they're going to reassert in 2014. So my recommendation is the same as I said in the article, which is for 2014, you absolutely want to continue to hold your core position as you determine that to be. And in terms of investment position, I think it's going to be problematic as to whether gold is going to be attractive until and unless it reasserts the primary trend. So don't be surprised to see it bounce around a lot. Many subscribers I know of are still holding positions that they don't want to sell unless it breaks the 1200 line. If it does break the 1200 line, we could easily see it going down to the 1100 line. So don't be surprised if that does. If it does, it still doesn't mean the primary trend won't reassert. We'll just have to wait and see. I said in the commentary that I put up this week that one of the most important things that's important to understand about this environment is that since gold peaked in the fall of 2011, we've seen another 500 million people around the world connect on the global internet through smartphones or tablets. In September 2011, we had approximately 850 million people online connected. We've added another 500 million. Many of those people are in Asia and the emerging markets. And so now we have 1.6 billion people connected through the internet. That's a very profound change in terms of, with very profound impact on both the financial system and the management of assets globally. And it's why I want you to read the wrap-up, because I talk about it a fair amount. What it does mean is that that the economy is shifting from what I call the global 2.0 model to the global 3.0 model, and it changes relatively what the opportunities are, including in the equity markets. And it changes the opportunity among the G7 nation companies as to what their opportunities are and what their focus is. And so remember that the fundamental economics of all financial markets is changing dramatically as a result. And if you get those 500 million people through their cell phones investing in a variety of ways, it can have a dramatic swing impact on not just retail businesses, but on financial markets as well. So, for example, if you literally have the growing middle class globally start to buy equities, it could have a dramatic impact. Instead, if they choose to buy gold, it could have a dramatic impact. So we're looking at a very dramatic change, and we're all going to hear a lot more about that in 2014. And it's one of the reasons that you're seeing tremendous focus and discussion on digital currencies, because digital currencies are the way that that reach that audience. We saw at one point at the end of the year a conversation between the Jersey Isle and the Channel Isle and the regulators in the UK about marrying Bitcoin with gold. If that happens, it's going to be off to the races, needless to say. So, so just be prepared for this thing to go many, many different ways. And I think that's why it's important with your investment position to not be vested in gold going in certain ways. And I, for one, believe in an investment position, not a core position, but an investment position, you can sell a position, and if gold turns, you can come back in. So so be prepared to be flexible with your investment positions. Okay, and make sure you take a look at that article, because I think it will help you think through this a little bit more clearly. It's up on the blog. It's called "What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals?" Okay, some great questions in Ask Catherine. I bought a large amount of gold from Kitco years ago. Some of the 10-ounce bars have changed color and have a magenta color aura on them. How can I find out what is wrong here? I seriously doubt that contacting Kitco will result in anything but denials that it's the same bars they sold me. I sent the question to Franklin, and he responded as follows. Gold coins might attain a sort of haze. A gold bar might darken just a little, but I don't know about a magenta aura. Only way to prove the genuineness of the bars is to perform a specific gravity test, which any commercial laboratory ought to be able to do. The person wrote years ago, so that puts 10-ounce bars out of the recent time period when tungsten counterfeits have appeared. Tungsten is so close in specific gravity that it might fool a specific gravity tester. And then Franklin says, another reason 10-ounce bars aren't such a good idea. I would also add that I think if you have your original invoice, and certainly Kitco should have a copy of that invoice and a record of the sale, I think it is worth contacting them. If you bought them and have your invoice and that's a recorded transaction, I wouldn't assume that they wouldn't be helpful. Dear Catherine, these are the same two questions I asked last week, but since there was no Ask Catherine segment in the wrap-up, I'm asking them again. Would you consider doing a Solaria report featuring the people you recommended to us at Rambus Chartology? Yes, I would. But the folks at Rambus Chartology are very quiet. They don't do radio shows, and they work through something other than their name. Rambus is a code name. So I respect their anonymity and have not pressured them to come on the Solaria report. But, I do recommend their work. I think Rambus is a remarkable chartist and does some great work in this area. Would you, in terms of the preservation of asset value and or appreciation of asset value in 2014, generally speaking, please rank the following three asset classes in the order in which you believe they will perform for investors in 2014? And then he asks, he lists three asset classes, one single-family homes, two equities, three precious metals. Very good question, but let me reframe it. And this is why I want you to read the wrap-up. I describe money moving from 2.0 to 3.0. So you have a world of 2.0 assets and 2.0 companies. And what I said about the housing market last year is what I'm going to say about it again. If you're in an area that's receiving significant 3.0 investment, the housing market's going to do very well. If you're in an area that's not receiving any 3-point investment, the housing market's going to do very poorly. So so it's not a matter of housing market versus equities. It's a matter of the housing market in an area that's strong for 3.0 versus 2.0. It's equities that are going to be winners or strong in 3.0 as opposed to 2.0. So within each asset class, like homes, like equities, you're seeing an extraordinary divergence of values. And so that's why you want to read the wrap-up and you want to understand this concept of 2.0 and 3.0. And when you look at whether it's where you work and what you do, how your business is positioned, the housing market, or equities, you don't want to look at things through the prism of homes versus equities. You want to look at homes and equities in 3.0 versus 2.0. So very, very big difference. Precious metals, interestingly enough, is a bridge. And I think a lot of the economic warfare going on in the precious metals market is about shifting money out of 2.0 and into 3.0 and building that bridge. I think this year precious metals is going to be in that battle zone. And so it's probably going to underperform most asset classes. But as I said, so we're in a year where anything can happen. And that's why this year you don't want to position yourself based on any prediction of where things are going to want to go. You're going to want to be positioned to be flexible and pay attention to where things are going. There's a great quote last year when Hugh Hendry finally capitulated on investing based on fundamentally said the only way this market makes sense is through the prism of trends. It's a very funny quote. We got one other comment from a subscriber that I thought was very interesting on the wrap-up, but it pertains to gold and silver, so I thought I'd read it. I read your year-end wrap-up and wanted to comment on the space economy and the comments on gold. When the space shuttle was flying in the 80s, a journal I read had a comment that if the shuttle flew into orbit, had the bay filled with gold, and then landed, all of that cargo, gold, would not cover the cost of the flight. While this makes nice fiction, the idea of harvesting an asteroid has been around since I was a pup. Nothing has ever come of it. To me, it has zero impact on our current gold prices or economy. It's an extreme niche, and so little energy money is being spent in this area, it truly doesn't matter in the global economy. If they were to bring a ton of gold to Earth at $1,500 an ounce, that would be approximately $48.2 million US. While a nice chunk of change, and certainly a lot of large pizzas, it's nothing to do with the trillions in the global economy. If they pulled it down from far orbit, the sheer shock to the markets would drop the price, which means their success would destroy the profits they are trying to achieve. To me, this is a rabbit hole and makes your argument seem shallow. What are some of the factors in 2013? I'm no expert, but I do not own any gold. However, based on my readings and curiosity, I would say the following is or has happened. You stated the primary answer in your report when you said gold dropped and S&P rose, leaving a 58-cent USD spread. Money flows to the greatest return, even if it's not always a wise choice. The big money dumped the mining stocks and the gold ETFs and precious metals to pursue a greater return. The amount of gold being mined today is greater than at any point in history. The Chinese have turned loose a lot of miners in their country, both legally and illegally, to mine for precious metals. The legal and illegal mining in South Africa and other countries continues to flood the market. Undersea fields. This is near-term an active field of gold mining. The first licenses have been granted, and the Chinese are going after this one. This is where the action will be, not in space. Robotic strip mining of the ocean floor around thermal vents is cheaper than any rocket. The economics makes sense, plus the old scrap and destroy the ecosystem for a decade before any regulatory agency gains control will be a huge incentive. Think of mining in the 1800s. Strip the metals and leave the hole in the ground and move on. In this case, nobody will be able to see the massive scraping going on at the bottom of the ocean. While the UN has jurisdiction in some areas, they are powerless and inept at almost everything they do. At any rate, thank you for your report. And he goes on and on. Anyways, but I thought those comments on supply were very interesting and very useful. Anyway, so that's it for our precious metals market report, first one of the year. I wish you good hunting and good investment this year. And I remind you of the quote that I used when I described the core, which was always keep enough coins to bribe the border guards. I would just say on a personal note, I've put a lot more money in my business than I put in gold, but I didn't sell any gold in 2013 because everything I own is core and I have no intention of touching it. The price could go to 900 and I'm not going to sell it and I'm not going to touch it. I think I wanted to close with another quote from Janet Yellen, who is the chairman-elect of the Federal Reserve. She said, and this is a recent quote, "I don't think anybody has a very good model for what makes gold prices go up or down." That is a comment of remarkable candor, very refreshing from the new Fed chairman. And I think as you listen to all the commentators talking about the gold prices and where they're going to go in 2014, I would recommend Janet Yellen's wisdom to you. Again, quote, "I don't think anybody has a very good model for what makes gold prices go up or down." I agree. I would say, however, that gold is at the very heart of the war for who will control the new emerging currencies globally. And so if you want to know where the power lines run, they absolutely run through the gold depositories and gold exchanges of this world. So, ladies and gentlemen, keep your core. That's it for the Precious Metals Market Report. I look forward to talking with you shortly on Money and Markets. We'll be right back.